Accession number 30134, reel number 1.
Okay, so that's Colonel Joe Sedgley.
Yeah, yeah.
And Joe, I call you Joe, and I think everybody else does,
yes,
Joe.
Yeah.
But I know, in fact, that your initials are something else, aren't they?
Yes. F.O., well, that's Ferdinand Octavius.
Okay. It's an unusual name, Joe.
Well, unusual, yes. Well, anyhow, yeah. that's origin, I mean, more bears. However, that is it. And I was born on the 30th of July, 1916. And I was educated in South London, Clapham, Clapham College, an excellent secondary school. Run by the Zabarian brothers, very, very strict and on almost a military style, but they gave one a very sound education, both religious and secular. And although not a public school, we always used to have a small trickle of people who went into the commissions in the service. And I was keen to be a soldier and an officer, a leader. And so instead, after the I think now it's O-levels, before they used to call it general schools.
Yes.
Instead of studying further advanced levels and that sort of thing, I studied for the Army entrance exam.
Before we start on that one, Joe, just briefly, you were saying off tape earlier that you had no military background and such, family military background. And
Well, there might have been. And
And the name Ferdinand Octavius, you said that was down to forebears or something.
Yes, yes. And the surname too.
Okay. Yes. What are the origins there, Joe?
Franco-German.
Oh, fine. Good. But you always wanted to be, even from a young age, I think you've hinted there, in the army.
Yeah.
And it was the army as opposed to any other force.
Well, it was the most accessible from my point of view, because I'm not technically gifted mathematically and so on. I would not have objected to the other services at all, except they required much higher qualifications academically than I possessed, particularly in terms of mathematics.
So how did you, in fact, get into the services, Jim?
Well, I sat for the army entrance examination in 1935. In London, and passed in 20th out of about, I worked hard, 20th out of about 200 or so, and entered Sandhurst in August 1935. And I was commissioned in 26th of August 1937, and to 1st Battalion East Lancashire Regiment, not having any particular affiliation to any regiment, because there was a strong pull, if one had a connection with the regiment, to go into that regiment. But there was no pull in my case. There were vacancies in the East Lancashire Regiment, and there I went.
What about the training there at Sandhurst?
Well, now, the thing is this. Royal Military College, as it was called in those days, Sandhurst, the object was to produce platoon commanders who would lead in the field. That was the basic thing anyhow. And the emphasis was on physical leadership, apart from the normal military qualification, courage, and a certain amount of nous too. But it was primarily physical. Today, when you look through the army list, or any army list, you find all sorts of technical qualifications, MA, BA, and so on. It's, you know, sort of boffin types.
Yes.
That wasn't the case in my day, but of course, in those days, university qualification, of course, was a rarity, relatively speaking. Now, I suppose, when everybody gets a degree, I suppose the army's got to keep pace, and that is why they're making young officers do all these things. But in my day, the object of Sandhurst was to produce, initially anyway, platoon commanders who could physically lead. That was the emphasis on, and it's significant that in the obituaries, which I always read when a serviceman appears, how many of these chaps were absolute experts in games and in high quality, because the emphasis was on that, physical, and when not training, games, fitness, leadership.
Now, and especially team games, Joe?
Oh, yes, team games, too. Now, the other thing is that people who did have brains and who wanted a more technical went to the sister organization, the Royal Military Academy, and that was in Woolwich. Now the two are combined. But that Royal Military Academy was called the shop in those days because it was, well, it was far more, I would say, less military, but there was much more brain work, much more study. And from the Military Academy came the gunners and the engineers. And the engineer, before you could get a commission, after you finished your military training, as far as the engineer, you were sent, at government expense, to do a 2-year course at Cambridge University, qualify engineering, before you took up your duties. Mind you, the engineers were a relatively small arm compared with the rest of the army, and it's significant that this combination of intellectual and military training is seen in so many of the senior posts occupied by Royal Engineer officers, because that certainly had an effect. In those days, now going again, pre-war, the signals was pretty well nobody's baby. It was there, but it was very much a sort of embryo. Now, the Royal Tank Regiment, or the Royal Tank Corps, existed, but that was rather experimental. After all, the tanks only came into the picture in the First War. We're not, apart from shooting the infantry in and crawling, you know, the big lumbering things they had.
So you were being trained, Joe, if I read this right, as an infantry officer.
That's right, yes. Anyway, I passed out. I did better than passing in. I passed out 11th. Worked hard, naturally, 18. And posted to the 1st Battalion East Lancashire Regiment, who were in Northern Ireland.
Which rank were you, Joe? What rank were you?
Second Lieutenant.
Okay.
Oh, right at the bottom. And there was a lovely green and peaceful place in those days. There were 4 battalions, ourselves, in Hollywood, which was a little place north of Belfast on the shores of Lake, Belfast Lock. There was a Welsh regiment in Belfast, the South Wales borderers in Londonderry, and the Northamptons in Ballykin, which was the musketry camp.
This is in 1937.
There was no riots or anything like that. And this is really surprising because it was only a bare 20 years after the Easter Risings in 1916, but it was so peaceful.
Yes.
And there were very few restrictions. One place, apart from India, where you had a chain going through the trigger guards in the armory, because the rifle snatching was one of the things the IRA indulged in, but they were harmless, really, in those days. Incidentally, again, in relation to time, I was commissioned in 1937. A mere 20 years back, they were fighting in the blood and mud of Passchendaele.
Yes.
That was a measure of time.
Yes.
And
Joe, just before you go on from there, this is 1937. Yeah. We know now with hindsight that the war breaks out in 1939.
Yeah.
Are there any rumblings on the horizon at this stage?
Well, no, not really. 1937, 1935, there's a plebiscite in the Saar, which gave the Saar back to Germany. Incidentally, 1st Battalion of the East Lancashire Regiment were part of the International Brigade to secure fair play. The other two units were the Dutch Marines and the Italian crack unit, the Savoy Grenadiers. And that was, 36, Hitler marched into the Rhineland, but the French did nothing. They could have done a lot. I mean, it would have been easier to pitch the Germans back into the Rhine. They had so few people. But it was one of those times when ourselves and the French didn't agree. When they looked over their shoulder at us, what we thought about it, we said, what the hell is all the trouble about? The Germans just going back into their own backyard after all German territory. But the thing that really put the thing really on a ominous basis was Munich, checks to that crisis.
Yep.
And also the annexation of Austria, but that was the next year. But 37, it was really the old days, colonial empire and so on, and that's it. And we weren't particularly preoccupied. I mean, we had a certain amount of preoccupation over Mussolini's acquisition of Abyssinia and so on, but and the Spanish Civil War. But that's really didn't unduly affect us, not right. in the same way as this Kosovo thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I said, it's a lovely green place, green and peaceful, and everything was as no problem. We did our usual training, which had its usual run, of course, platoon company, and then finishing up with manoeuvres, battalion manoeuvres, and integration with other units too. Now, the atmosphere at that time, now this, it was really the 1914-18 army, because a lot happened in the 2 years before the war. The army that I joined in 1937 was really the old pre-war 1914-18 army, and everything pretty well was in fours. You form fours, marching column, you form two deep, inspection in line, and drill for that. And there were four sections to a platoon, two Lewis gun sections, one and two assault sections, four platoons to a company, four companies to a battalion. In fact, it was in fours. Mm-hmm. In 2 years, we moved on to threes. The structure of the army was typically pre-war. Everybody of the rank of major and above had seen service in the War of the Trenches. And it took a long time to become a major in those days of dead men's shoes, when you had to wait until somebody resigned or died or promoted. And there weren't all that number of majors around either. There were only two in the battalion, one second in command, the other probably commanding headquarters company. A rifle company's command in those days was a captain's command, not the major's.
Mm-hmm.
And the major was somewhat of a revered person. And when he came into the room, he was entitled, first of all, to be mounted, but he was still a horse, to wear field boots and spurs. And when he came into a room, into the mess, everybody got to their feet. You didn't speak to a major unless you were very senior, unless he spoke to you, and that was the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there were quite a few senior captains who'd seen more service too, and also some warrant officers and senior sergeants.
What was the command of a major at that stage, Joe?
The command of the major was second in command, or he might command one of the companies.
Okay.
Yeah. But that was the way it was. In the artillery, for example, the battery command was always a major, but then he had a lot of equipment on his hands, horses as well, a lot. And that was measured rather by his responsibility for equipment. And also batteries tended in those days to act independently as small units, not as regiments.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but as far as the infantry is concerned, the rifle company was a captain's command. So that's the way it was. It was strict, hierarchical, but we were all very happy. Everybody had his place, and it was a place for everybody, and you had to keep it.
And you personally at this stage, Joe, I would imagine were extremely happy, because you were now an officer in an infantry battalion doing something that you wanted to do as a
exactly,
young boy.
Yes,
a young boy.
Yes, yes. That is so. Now, again, the army in general was still horsed, by and large. We still had in the barracks mule-drawn limbers, brasswork and harness gleaming, and did all the barrack chores, rations and everything else. There was a string of six riding horses for umpiring, and also for ceremonial occasions for people who were entitled to be mounted. Guns were the 18-pounder and 4.5-inch howitzer of the First War, all horse-drawn.
Mm.
And the cavalry was horse, too, at that time. So it was very much that type of army. But a very tough army. It may not have the equipment the Germans did, but it was a very tough army. They were all regular, and training invariably included a long route march each week with something else to do at the end of it, not just flop down on the ground on a salt course or something like that. And of course, every regular went at some time or other to India, where the 2nd Battalion of the regiment was always kept up to more or less full strength. And they had arduous duties, and sometimes found themselves on the frontier, and they came back hardened and bronzed when the troop ships came to bring them to be demobbed and take on another lot. But it was hard and it was tough. And things were pretty Spartan too in the barracks. Our barracks, and that applied to all of them, were Victorian. All your loos and washing facilities were all outside. Doesn't matter what the weather was, you had to go out there. And cold water.
No central heating, Joe?
No. You had, in the barrack room, night purposes, you had a night urine. If you wanted to pee, that's where you went. And it was in the morning. That's it. If you wanted to do something more, you went out in the loo. There was a stove at the end of the barrack room, which was a little charcoal, no coke burning thing, and that's it. No central heating.
Okay, Joe, that was your alarm to remind you of time.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yes, even the officers' quarters were pretty Spartan. I mean, my place in the officers' mess had a room which was partitioned, curtain, one size bed, and one of these old-fashioned washstands with a marble top, a ewer and a jug, no running water. The other was a little living room with a table, an easy chair, and another chair. And a coal bucket to have a ration of coal, and that was it. Your batman made up fire in the evening at the coal burner. No central heating. It's only recently that they had slip baths installed, and even a wooden partition, sometimes a queue.
Yes.
And also the loos were outside, no question of doing it. So that was, it was, as I say, typical Victorian barracks. And anyhow, that was, so life was pretty Spartan. Now the soldier in those days wore khaki serge tunic buttoned up to the neck, puttees up to the knees, and for parades he wore a leather belt, and training, webbing equipment of the First War type with little pouches which contained 10 rounds, 303. He had a rifle and bayonet. The Enfield rifle, probably one of the best that was ever produced. We got some very shoddy things during the war, Mark IV, but the Enfield could, in the hands of a really fat marksman, get the target a 1,000 yards, had a magnificent backsight with also a wind adjustment. A magnificent rifle had that, 18-inch bayonet. He was taught to throw a grenade, a Mills grenade, which is still in practice today, and if for launching at any distance, he had a discharger cup which fitted on the rifle, and with a ballistic charge, that's got it to the distance.
It's in effect lobbed the grenade further.
That's right, yes. I mean, if you lobbed a grenade, you had to be undercover before it went off, because the bits and pieces come back at you.
Right.
But if you wanted to throw it further, then you had this discharger cup which really acted as a small mortar.
Yes.
Now, and as I said, there were two loose gun sections and two assault sections. Now, as far as supporting weapons, you know, battalion supporting weapons, the only things there were 2 3-inch mortars. And the ones that we had were really only training mortars. The slipper barrel and then the round just went off. They're only training mortars. And that is that's the only supporting weapon we had in those days within the battalion, apart from machine guns. Now, we had also this was mechanization slowly coming in. We had four experimental trucks of the 1500 weight type, not 1500 weights. We knew them 1500 weight type, same size, and we call them Beetles. But that's what we had in the way of mechanisation.
Just to go back there on armament, Joe, you had no anti-tank
weapons. No, that came in later.
Okay.
No, I'll come into that. That was it. Now, the single platoon, all they had were the Morse, of course, field telephone wire, helio and flag. Remember, a lot of the work was done in India in those of
yes.
And dispatch riders. No wireless. No wireless communication whatsoever. now, during my time, very early on, the Lewis guns were taken away. And we were issued now, in all seriousness, with wooden rattles to simulate machine gun fire.
Mm-hmm.
And they were items of store. Machine gun, the Vickers machine guns, we used to have a Vickers machine gun company, one of the companies, but that, those were taken away and were grouped in, excuse me, machine gun battalions. So we just had four rifle companies. There was one Bren gun in the armory, which everybody looked upon with great awe. And I was sent, the following year, 1938.
Still in Ireland, Joe?
Oh, yes, still in Ireland. I was sent to Hythe to do a small arms course, a long small arms course, infantry arms, infantry weapons. Now, that was the mecca for all weapon training, staffed by a magnificent corps of instructors, SAS, not Special Air Service, but Small Arms School.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they were magnificent people. They were, probably the world's experts in that. And I did a course. Now, on that course, I learned the Bren gun. I learned a lot more, too. I learned the Bren gun, they produced the Bren gun, and also the anti-tank, boys' anti-tank rifle, a five-inch thing, fired a five-inch bullet, which had the kick, the thing had the kick of a mule and was a brute to carry and was pretty useless because
yes.
It bounced off the German tanks.
Mm.
And didn't last very long at all. And the two-inch mortar, which of course is still in with us today, and that was a very useful little weapon.
Yeah. Of course, you didn't realise that the weapon at that stage was useless. You realised this later on when it bounced off the German tanks, you're saying?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, not only us, but I mean, everybody.
Sure.
Anyhow, I worked hard, was keen, and I came out with distinguished, on the strength of which I was made, taken out of company duties and made weapon training officer, or they used to call it a regimental musketry officer. And from then until I joined Marcus for the outbreak of war, I was constantly teaching, training, instructing.
Mm.
Both officers and NCOs on these new weapons which had just come out.
Were you a good shot yourself, particularly, Joe? Were you a good shot yourself, particularly?
Not a particularly good shot.
Okay.
No, my eyes were not very up to it, but I could shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Also forming cadres who would instruct other people, because it's all very new. I mean, these 2 years before the war, there's just a tremendous sort of surge of things, that, you know, a complete change from night and day, pretty well, as you can see.
Yeah.
New weapons coming in, trucks coming in, all sorts of things. Because it was right, and then, of course, Munich happened at the time that I was at Hythe, 1938, and the Czech crisis, and we very nearly went to war. And I remember seeing a pathetic sight on a rainy evening. We the officers on this, an officer's course, were put on standby to rejoin our units. It was like that. And we saw these magnificent instructors on a rainy day standing by with a rain cape, a ground sheet they used in those mm-hmm. days, standing by. A Bren gun mounted on its tripod with a box of ammunition just there, you know, because that's the tension yeah. It was. Anyhow.
This is the time of, you say, Munich. This
that's
is
right.
The time of Chamberlain beating our time.
Right, when he came back with a bit of paper. Anyhow, that was it, and I got back to the battalion. As I say, I was promptly made weapon training officer on the spot and got on with that job, and that is what. And I was teaching, instructing in these weapons, and also in minor tactics, firing, that sort of thing, right up to the outbreak of war.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
So that was, now we've covered what the soldier had, how he was armed, and roughly the other arms of the army at that time, and the sort of general atmosphere. And that was it. Now, 1938 was quite a hectic period. We seem to have sort of been roused from the sort of old way of life, 1937 and so on, which the army had been following right from the end of the First War and got itself settled into that sort of, shall I say, colonial garrisoning and that sort of thing. and peaceful existence. Because at that time, it was quite clear to most people that we'd probably be at war very shortly. In fact, we were.
Yep.
But in 1938, you see, all these weapons started descending on us. That's why I'd hated time instructing and so on. Bren guns, anti-tank rifles, 2-inch mortars, and we also got 9 Bren gun carriers.
Right.
And that was quite a thing too, the light track vehicles. And the carrier, and they formed a carrier platoon. That was, there was one for the commander and 3 sections of 3 each, 9 carriers. And it was a rapid change, I say, from the Imperial garrisoning army to one would possibly have to take the field in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous change in mentality, in adapting to new weapons and training and so on. Artillery too, got 25 pounders, which is the gun howitzer, with 360 travels, you know, on its wheel. Also a 2-pounder anti-tank gun, which was a magnificent little weapon mechanically, but again bounced off most German tanks. Although they were used, and tanks were armed with 2-pounder guns right from a late stage, but they could only be effective if you approached a weak side of the tank.
Were you in a division at this stage?
Sorry?
Were you in a division at this stage? In a division?
Particular division? No. We're still talking about Northern Ireland.
Okay.
Still talking about Northern Ireland. Now, also, sometime in 38 or early 39, we were issued with battle dress. Everybody.
Yes.
So that's another thing. And then we started going in threes. Fours were abolished. And the drills changed to conform to three. So it was a very rapid change from an old, rather peaceful and sort of routine way jerked into a wartime atmosphere or preparation for what was to come.
Yes.
So that was a rapid transformation. Now that carries us until mobilisation. Have you got any more questions on that?
No, I think we've so far...
You've got the atmosphere.
The atmosphere, I think you've painted that very well, Jan. No, so now mobilisation.
Yes, well, that came in 1939, and we mobilised, of course, in Northern Ireland, and it was all done to a strict... I mean, the mobilisation timetable was... We'd always had it. I mean, it was... existing for a year dot, and it was locked up in the order room somewhere, and came out when it's necessary, and every day had its task. And I'm not going to go through a task, obviously, it's pointless, but the one amusing thing is that a D plus whatever it was appeared on the list, tasks and duties, sharpened bayonets. Anyhow, that concerns probably, those things are probably drawn up in 1919.
Yes.
However, that was it. Mm. Now, having mobilised, of course, the battalion was stripped of everything, you know, like the band and the drums and all the mess, all the rest. We were living a bit more Spartan-like. We moved then to England, to Wooler in Northumberland, where we joined the 42nd East Lancashire Division, which was a TA division. And we were in 126 Brigade, alongside the 5th Border and the 5th King's Own, TA battalions. And the other brigades, likewise, had one regular and 2 TA.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 42 East Lancashire Division, and the brigade, and the division with which we went to war.
Which company were you with at this stage?
Well, now, that is when I joined B Company, Marcus Irvin Andrews, Captain
Commanding
Company, because I said it was Captain's Command in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved, got integrated there, then we moved to Rothbury, a bit further north, in deep snow. In a bit further north in Northumberland, and then at that time we were warned. Anyway, we didn't. It was the time of the Russo-Finnish War. We weren't at war with Russia. We weren't at war with Finland either. But obviously, feelings were sympathetic to the Finns, who were doing extremely well against a giant, and there was some thought of giving some sort of help via Norway, which hadn't been invaded yet by the Germans. And this was to be affect the battalion only, and it was so secret that not even division came into it. It was the Red Network, but we were told to be on standby and reduce the battalion to 600. So there's a certain amount of selection, but everything was so completely secret, top secret, that not even division came into it. It was a straight network. However, that didn't come off, that scrubbed. And then we moved to Swindon. That was in the January of 40.
Swindon, Wiltshire.
That's right, yes, Swindon, Wiltshire. And that, and there we got down to intensive training to knock the brigade and division into shape. And as we were a regular, well-trained battalion, we were often called upon to give demonstrations to the division.
Yes.
But that was, and that was